Accession number 30419, reel 8.
Quite a way. I think the it was an hour and 10 minutes to Aldergrove in a jet province, so that's quite a long one. And the one that where I was going to Scotland and had to land in Yorkshire, I remember that one particularly because, of course, I only had a flying suit on, and I had to go and have lunch in the officer's mess because there was nothing wrong with the aeroplane, it was just frozen. But whilst they were refuelling it and all the rest, I was allowed to go and have lunch in my flying suit.
Was that unusual?
It was, very unusual in those days, but they understood. The other thing we did on navigation, of course, was low-level cross-countries. That really was fun. That really was fun.
Where was that?
In the flatlands of around the Wash, Lincolnshire and Norfolk, there was a low-flying area, which was was around Boston Stump. Boston has a distinctive spire on the church, as if it's been knocked off. So that was always good. I'm not sure how low we flew. I think it was 200 feet. It was fairly civilised because we didn't have to...
That doesn't sound terribly civilised.
Oh, well, they didn't want us to go low to imperil ourselves, low enough to imperil ourselves or to disturb the population too much. Very noisy aeroplane, the jet provost. But we used to... There's one here. It's an hour. We used to do an hour. And solo, we used to go low-level solo for an hour, flying around. You had to recognise, it was all map reading, and you just had to recognise the turning points. You used to, on the flying suit, there was a little panel on the right leg with a bit of perspex in it, and you could write on that in a chinagraph pencil. So you'd write the headings and the elapsed time before the turning point, and so you would use that as an aide memoir, and you had a map, of course. So the thing about low level flying in a single engine single person aeroplane is that you've got to hold the map at the same time as fly the aeroplane and operate the radio and all the rest, and that's quite a challenging thing to do. So I think, yes, that, so it was all pretty much different from the Tiger Moth, wasn't it?
It does sound that way.
Yeah, and it's all built up to a final test for wings, which would have been in June of 62. So it was now a year and a half of training, and the number of hours we flew, I think I've got a record of that, which was 180 hours. It was 180 hours, of which 58 were as first pilot captain solo, and we did about just 10 hours of actual instrument flying, but another 22 of simulated, so enough. And we did the test for wings. There we are, passed that.
What did the test for wings involve?
Well, you did everything on the trip that you had learnt. You take off, practice engine failure after takeoff, climb away out of the local area, show the aerobatics, don't get lost. You'd have to make sure that you kept... The other thing about aerobatics, of course, is you have to keep orientated, know which direction you're going. You don't want to start flying away from the airfield when you finish. Find your way back to the airfield, do perhaps a a practice flame out procedure, perhaps a practice pan, a radar controlled approach, circuits and landings. And that would be that.
And you passed?
Yes, yes. And very proud I was, too, to have done that. Particularly because we built up to the climax of everything else. There were... By this time, I was an under-officer. In the last 2 terms... we had under officers, so certain guys were selected to be promoted and became prefects. The big thing, and I became an under officer, but not until the last term. I was quite disappointed not to be made an under officer in the first term, but it did tell me that I wasn't doing everything right. I was doing an awful lot. I remember my economics tutor nearly slaughtering me for taking a part in the play, the college play, Nude with Violin, it was called. And I played an American reporter with an atrocious American accent, wearing Bob O'Brien's riding raincoat because as a trench coat, and I thought it was great fun, but he said I haven't got time for that, but I had to do something else other than bloody studies, because the studies were crippling, really. Every evening when everybody else was out boozing and having a relaxing time, I was writing essays, and so were half a dozen of us. So were 2 dozen, because the ones who were doing the AFRAS, they were having to do the same sort of thing. That came to a climax in, must have been June, mustn't it? We came down to London to take the exams at the university. We stayed at the RAF Club. I thought that was absolutely wonderful. I was in London. Oh, fantastic. Well, I was quite relaxed about the exams, I remember, because I said to anybody who wanted to know, look, if I don't know enough now, then there's nothing to be done. But I knew I'd done a lot of work and understood it all. I had to do papers in military studies, French and economics. And we went to the Bloomsbury examination halls. There were girls taking the examination, ordinary people. It was wonderful. Of course, there was all the sport as well. I was playing cricket through the summers and hockey through the winters, and I was in the first 11 of both of those, so I had all that to do. And and I was also selected to carry the colour. C Squadron had won the drill competition again, so it was the colour squadron, so I was going to have to carry the Queen's colour on the graduation parade and on all the parades up to them. That was another responsibility, and I had to pass all the other exams which you took to become an officer, because there were exams in everything, mathematics, airmanship, navigation. There were exams through that summer of 62.
And fairly exhausting.
Yeah, it was wonderful. It was wonderful I'd had a set of challenges and that I'd never have had at university. I would have been a disaster at university, but the discipline and the having to do it got me through all this. And I can remember when I got called to the commandant's office and told that I got a degree. I think it was, and still is, the proudest moment of my life, that I managed to get this bloody degree. There were 3 of us did it. I've got a picture of us here, if you want to see it. we went on passing out parade as BAs, and we became pilot officer BA.
Fantastic.
Tony Ross was a really cultured gentleman. He used to smoke Balkan Sobrani, I can remember, cigarettes, and he went to join the Sultans of Oman's Air Force. Bob O'Brien became Air Secretary in due course. Very distinguished career he had. And there's me. I got the École de l'Air trophy for French studies.
Oh, we talked about this last time, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, we talked about it because you had the trip down to London.
Yes.
Yes, we did, yeah.
That's right. I took a linguist exam down there. Mm. We were going to go for the interpreter, but it just proved a bridge too far. But I got the linguist, French linguist, and we did quite a lot of liaison with the École de l'Air, which was interesting. Trip to France for that. We went to America to visit, I've forgotten about that, must have been Easter 62. We went to, Bristol, Britannia, across the Atlantic, landed in Newfoundland, just at the limit of its range, and then went down to Washington, visited the Strategic Air Command headquarters in Omaha, Nebraska. We went across to the Rockies and visited the American Air Force Academy at Colorado Springs. And we came back to New York and went to West Point. And then we spent two nights in New York, we checked our baggage into the rooms, didn't open them, stayed up all night twice. Bedraggled lot, visited the UN headquarters. Then we got on the old Bristol Britannia and flew back again. Fantastic.
What difference did you know? Did you notice anything different about the American system as compared to the system you were in?
Oh, yeah. And how? I'll tell you about it in a minute.
You good?
Right. Yes, when the United States Air Force Academy guys had come to visit us, they found Cranwell really like a holiday camp, despite the fact there were strict disciplines. But when we went to Colorado Springs, we understood why, because everything is done to a very strict honor code. And if you do anything wrong, knowingly or unknowingly, you have to report yourself. And everything's done at right angles, too. You eat at right angles, so the fork has to go out and down like that. And
really?
You have to sit at attention all the time at meals, and you have to respond in the correct manner. You have to do that at Cranwell to the flight sergeant, but you can always get away with a bit of banter. But at Colorado Springs, it was all rod of iron stuff. And we were assigned a host. Of course, their haircuts are criminal, all the uniforms are creased, and we must have looked, after certainly a few days in a Bristol Britannia and Washington, D.C., a little bit disheveled, but compared with them. And Colorado Springs is very high. I forget the altitude, but there was a bit of lassitude amongst us because of the getting used to the altitude. So we had a host assigned to us, and mine had a Chevrolet Impala, and we went down to the Strip, Colorado Springs Strip, and it was just like a James Dean film. We'd only seen it in the movies, and there it was, a real Western town. With bars down the side of the strip, and we went to a bar and we had a couple of cocktails, and or maybe it was beers, I can't remember, and chatted up a couple of girls, and then we we were on the way back, and it was really very interesting, very exciting. On the way back, he got booked for speeding. Okay, you get booked for speeding, you shrug your shoulders, but he had to go and report himself for having been booked for speeding. And he was gated for the whole weekend. He couldn't leave camp for the whole weekend. And as I was with him, and as I was his guest, I couldn't leave camp for the whole weekend. And, well, but that mattered, actually, because that evening, or the next evening, we had a dance. And we'd been asked our height beforehand. And we found out why. They assigned a lady of the local community to each of us. So my partner for the evening was 6'2", the daughter of the Canadian air attaché. Great girl, statuesque. And, oh, he got on like a house on fire. And she asked me, I can't have known about the gating then, because she asked me to go to, she'd like to take me to the mountains the next day. Ski resorts, fantastic. And she had a big Dodge motor car, so I was all set for that. And it must have been the next morning that this guy was carpeted and gated. I couldn't go. I could have cried. The girl turned up at the guard room to collect me and to be told, very sorry, Flight Cadet Annett, under officer Annett, I was under officer by this time, proudly sporting my one ring round my sleeve. Couldn't go, never saw her again. Terribly sad, and I had to sit watching American bloody football on the telly. We played them at, the cricket side played them at baseball, which they won resoundingly. The rugby side played them at American football, and our rugby side won resoundingly, because they hadn't a clue. I mean, they were pampered, these American football guys, compared with our rugby people. McCarthy can tell you about that. He was the rugby captain. And we had swimming, I think, but I had a very scary experience in that I plunged to the bottom of the pool and didn't come up again, because it was, I think it was 7,000 feet, something ridiculous altitude. So, of course, the pressure was much less. I did come up, but it was a hell of a struggle. So we had a full and varied time. We then flew to West Point, where the discipline is even stricter. I found West Point the most awful place in the world.
Why?
Because, well, Colorado Springs at least had the Rocky Mountains and airplanes, but West Point just is down in the deep valley of a river north of New York, and it's hell on earth. I mean, the discipline there is so extraordinarily strict. And there wasn't any Chevrolet Impala and the strip down the side. We were just in West Point for 2 days. We then got to New York, where we were ready to let rip. And we checked our bags in this hotel, this skyscraper block. We went downtown, and we stayed downtown until we had to go and visit the UN headquarters. We went to Birdland, which is a famous jazz place. We went to a burlesque show where we bought the strippers' drinks. And we went to... we had breakfast in the diner. Nothing could be finer. It was really... really quite extraordinary. New York in 1962 was a romantic place for us. So we had those visits. We also used to visit Sandhurst and Britannia Royal Naval College, Dartmouth, for playing cricket and hockey. So that summer, when I was going to take my exams, we had a weekend of cricket. It was one and only time I played two-day cricket, two innings, 2 days. So everybody went rushing up to London Saturday evening. I couldn't, because I was opening the bowling the next morning. I didn't mind, to be quite honest. It was a wonderful experience to play 2 days of cricket in the sunshine at Sandhurst. We went to, I remember there was a measles epidemic, and we flew to Dartmouth. We were allowed to fly to Dartmouth. Travel was restricted in Great Britain. Was it measles or flu? But we flew to Dartmouth and went, played hockey, went out on their boats, had a wonderful time, of course, drank too much. And at Dartmouth, Kathy, they gave each and every one of us a carton of players' full-strength Navy Cut cigarettes. Gave them to us. Because in the Navy, haven't they, smoking rations were free. I suppose it went along with the rum ration. Which we smoked with great glee, of course. We didn't know any better. We all smoked. Everybody smoked. So there were all those visits, and then the exams, then the wings, and then the passing out, and you graduated, and there was a passing out parade. One of the passing out parades, when we were there, I think it was the first, the Queen came along too, because she gave us a new colour. And my mother came along to that one. Parents were invited to passing out parades, and that was quite a memorable one. Princess Margaret came. I think she was quite pretty, but I couldn't see her because she's only about 4'2" and I'm 8'6". So I had to look. I couldn't see. She passed along the ranks below my line of vision. I forget who it was who took our passing out parade, but it was a distinguished officer. And my chum Kiwi Thompson got the Sword of Honour. He was an ex Horton cadet who, therefore, he'd done 3 years at Horton, then 3 years at Cramwell. His brother had got, he was a Royal New Zealand Air Force guy, and his brother had got the Sword of Honour, and his mother and his brother were there to see him receive it.
What is the Sword of Honour?
It's the top prize. It's the best all-round cadet in all respects. And Kiwi Thompson had set out to win the Sword of Honour because his brother had won it, and he thoroughly deserved it. He was narrowly beat Val McCarthy, who everybody thought was going to get the Sword of Honour, but in event he got the second, he got the runner-up prize, as it were. I got the A. Cordelaire Trophy, which meant that I could go to the cocktail party for prize winners, which my mother enjoyed immensely. There was the commandant had a famous batman who had a hearing aid, and he looked very much like Boris Karloff in the Frankenstein movies, and he went round with a jug of gin and Italian vermouth, and he kept on filling my mother's glass up with it, and she came out with some highly inappropriate secrets about me, one of which was that she was quite sure I'd be good at drill because I carried the colour, because I was so good at dancing round the maypole. Well, I never heard the last of that from the drill sergeant, whom we've met subsequently. Oh, dancing round the maypole, Mr. Annett, eh? And several things like that. It was it was a wonderful occasion. She had a great time. And then we had the graduation ball. We could take girlfriends, of course, and my girlfriend came. Nearly finished my Air Force career, actually, because she stayed the night in my room. I had a flat, an under-officer's flat.
When did you get that?
I got that when I became an under-officer, and that was terrific because it gave me a bit of seclusion. It was up in a secluded area, and you had your own bathroom. And it meant that I could wall myself up in there and do the revision for the exams. I think that was the saving of my academics at Cranwell. I was able to do that. And I mean, I don't think we were just so exhausted that she fell asleep in my room, sort of thing. But the next morning, there was her little Morris motor car parked out in the middle of the parade square. Anyway, we got away with it. But had it been discovered that I had a woman in my room that night, I would have been chucked out of the Air Force.
Really?
That was the rule. So that was a memorable graduation ball, and then we all went our ways. And as usual, it was an enormous... It was with mixed feelings that we all left and drove away. Big sense of anticlimax. But we did know by then where we were going next. And I was going with a group of chums, of course, to the advanced flying training school at Oakington on the Varsities. But that wasn't going to be until after quite a considerable graduation leave. And off we went to enjoy another vacation before that.
So when did you start at Oakington? This is it. We're in 62, yes? Or 63, am I?
62. Yes. We went to... it's near Cambridge. It's just north of Cambridge. It's a lovely little station. I think there were about a dozen of us went from the entry. You either went there for advanced flying on for transport and multi-engined, or you went to Valley, which is in Anglesey, North Wales, for the advanced jet training. And I was never a candidate for advanced jet training because I was too tall and my low G threshold, but great for all the others, but except that I was again fortunate in that I could never join the V Force because I was too big, or the Canberra Bomber, I was too big. But for the transports and the Shackleton, which was the maritime aeroplane, I was fine. And I wanted to go on Shackletons. It was my ambition to fly the Shackleton. We'd been at Cramwell. We went on a visit to the Maritime Warfare Training Centre at Ballykelly in Northern Ireland, where we'd done some simulated submarine hunting. And I found that, again, mental challenge and exciting, and seemed to have a purpose to it.
I was going to say, how do you hunt submarines?
Well, you've got... you drop a sonar buoy, so that gives you a sonar signal, and the Shackleton is bristling with aerials and electronics, and you first find your submarine, and then you've got to guess where he's going, work out where he's going, use the sonar signals to give you an estimated direction, try and outthink the captain of the submarine who's trying to outthink you, because he probably knows you're there. You may have seen a periscope. A radar may have picked up a periscope, which will give you a first sighting of direction. And then you've got to go and bomb it, basically, with depth charges, and hope you hit it. But there's others, maritime patrols, there's others, there's search and rescue. The Shackletons carry underneath them, they'd carry stuff they can drop, dinghies and supplies and radio beacons to pinpoint where the survivors are, all this kind of thing. You've got to know about ships and ship recognition so you don't go and bomb one of your own side. I found it all fascinating. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to fly Shackleton. So the first stage was to get through advanced flying training at Oakington. we must have got there in September. The